I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Years ago this month, Walt Disney World opened in Central Florida. In 1971, the attraction had only a single theme park, the Magic Kingdom, with about two dozen rides, including the Haunted Mansion, Snow White's Adventures, and the Country Bear Jamboree. Initial attendance was weak, and Disney stock tumbled, though that turned around. Today, the Walt Disney World Resort is a giant amusement complex with four theme parks, two water parks, 33 resorts, hotels, and much, much more. 17 million visitors come annually. Nearly 3% of the state's gross domestic product comes from Walt Disney World. 40 years after the mouse stopped in Central Florida, we'll look at the history behind creating Walt Disney World with author Rick Fogelsong and examine what it's like inside the company with former executive Lee Cockerell. That's ahead on Intersection. There is magic in that mouse, and we're looking at the four-decade impact of Disney on Central Florida this week on Intersection. I'm joined by Rick Fogelsong, professor of politics at Rollins College. He's also author of the book Married to the Mouse, Walt Disney World and Orlando. Rick, good to have you in.
Nice to be here, Mark.
Also with us is Lee Cockerell, who served as executive vice president of operations at the Walt Disney World Resort until 2006, when he retired after 16 years with Disney. He's author of Creating Magic, 10 Common Sense Leadership Strategies from a Life at Disney. Lee, good to have you back.
Hi there.
Rick, I want to start with you. Disney has become synonymous with Orlando and Central Florida, but talk to me about the impact of Walt Disney World on this region. 3% of the state economy generated by this one company. Is it possible to overstate the impact that Disney's had on this region?
Oh, I really don't think so. You know, there wasn't a lot going on here in Central Florida. We had the Martin Company since 1956, which becomes, of course, Lockheed Martin. But there wasn't much more, and the decision of the Walt Disney Company to build their East Coast Disneyland, as they called it initially, in Orlando was transformative for this area. Suddenly we became a tourist draw, where before the challenge for local leaders was somehow to find a gimmick to stop people from passing by Orlando on their way to Miami, because it was Miami that tourist went to, and if not Miami, they went to the coast. But Walt Disney not only transformed this area, but also the nature of tourism in Florida. It had historically been the natural environment that attracted people here. And of course, he took advantage of the climate, which is natural. But beyond that, he created with the theme park a man-made environment. And that's what we have here, a man-made environment, not only in Disney theme park, but at Universal and the other fun zones as well.
Now, Florida, of course, a very big state. How did Central Florida and the Orlando area come to be the location that was chosen?
You know, a key date was November 22nd, 1963. And some of us of a certain age, we know what that date is. But Walt Disney and an entourage of his had checked into a hotel in Tampa under assumed names so as not to alert the media. And they flew east to Orlando. They flew over the crisscross of Interstate 4 and Florida's Turnpike. They saw the fallow land nearby. And Walt, according to two people in the plane, said, "That's it. That's where we go." They flew on to New Orleans, where they disembarked. And as they were in a taxi on their way to the hotel, they saw people crying in the streets. And they had the cabbie turn on the radio, and they learned that John Kennedy had been assassinated. And so, as I write about in my book, Married to the Mouse, it was, you know, an amazing day, a terrible day for America. But it was also a day when, though people here didn't know it yet, a decision had been made that was going to be transformative.
And what was that initial conversation, that relationship like between Walt Disney or his representatives and the state of Florida?
Well, Walt dies very early in this process. Walt died in December of 1966. He held one press conference here in Orlando in November 65. And really, the company is led by Brother Roy when negotiations are undertaken with the state of Florida about building a theme park here and getting authority for the Disney government, the Reedy Creek Improvement District, that was authorized by state law in 1967 to provide services to the company so that they would not have to depend upon a government not their own, but also to give them immunity from building inspections, land use zoning requirements, and things of that sort, something that the company wanted in order to build their East Coast Disneyland.
Now, what was the sense? Did you, in your research, discover were state leaders pushing for this more than local leaders or vice versa? And, you know, what tempted, do you think, Disney to actually come to Florida?
Well, initially, the company was interested in Ocala because when you looked at Florida, Central Florida from California, Ocala made sense because it was in the population epicenter of the state. Ocala's problem was that it did not have the crisscross of roads that were needed. And it's important to understand why that was important, because the company wanted to build a theme park in Orlando that would be 10 times the size of the one Disneyland in California. And to do that, they needed to import tourists, because we didn't have a large enough population in the state of Florida to make such a park work. So if you were going to import tourists, it was vital to have the road connections. And, of course, those of us in your listening area, we know those road connections, you know, I-4, I-95, I-75, to bring the tourists down from the Northeast, to bring the tourists from the Midwest to us. That's what sealed the deal for us.
Did you get, in your research, the sense that immediately after the deal was signed, Central Florida started to see the impact, or was there a ramping up process before people started to realize just how big this was going to be?
Well, during the construction period, you had 9,000 workers working to construct the park in a four-year period. 9,000, big number, not a huge number, but there are all sorts of ancillary jobs created thereby. On 436 became known, State Road 436, as Apartment House Row. All those apartments that are there now, they sprung up in the period when Disney was under construction. I looked at some numbers today. In 1969, 3.5 million tourists came to Orange County, and that number jumped to 10 million by 1972 after the opening of the theme park in 1971.
You mentioned that Disney ended up getting a lot of concessions from the legislature, yeah, the state, local leaders. What are some of those concessions that came out of that deal, and why did Disney want those?
What the company built here was in many ways a response to their experience in California. Walt did not like, and others in the company did not like, the ticky-tacky environment that surrounds Disneyland. People who've been to Disneyland know what I'm talking about, a kind of neon jungle of restaurants and motels and the like. And so to avoid that, they had a twofold strategy. One was to buy enough land so that there would be a buffer between the built-up theme park and surrounding land uses. You know, iDrive's not too pretty, but at least you can't see it from the Disney theme park. The other strategy was to be able to have a government that they could control. And to do that, they got a charter from the state of Florida to create the entity I mentioned before, the Reedy Creek Improvement District, that would be able to provide services for the company. And since they were able to get essentially what they wanted, they asked for more things that they really needed, like the authority in state law to build a nuclear power plant. The view of nuclear power is different at that time than it is now. To build an airport, to not only have fire service, but also police service as well, in addition to the panoply of other things that local governments do to provide water, sewer service, that kind of thing.
And so this deal, because it has such a wide-ranging scope, has really built up this kind of, in some ways, a paranoia about Disney, because, like you said, it has police responsibilities, it has utilities, it has all these different facilities, which would be part of a normal city. So what is your take on that? Is that true, or is this something that has been used benevolently?
Well, I have a sort of mixed assessment of this. On the one hand, the Disney company said they were going to build a real town here where 20,000 people would live and work and play. And that was the premise on which the argument was made for why they needed that government. And that they never did, nor did they ever intend to, based on research that I did at the Disney Archives. On the other hand, what they did build is, I think, one of the most fascinating urban environments in the world, frankly. And as I write about in my book, it's an object lesson in the in the study of cities to see what's the best way to build a city, to do it under normal conditions in America where you have capitalism, that is to say fragmented land ownership, and political democracy, which is also fragmenting, or to build it under these Disney conditions, almost like in feudal France, where you have centralized land ownership. The king owns everything in the feudal context, and we have centralized governmental control. And what Disney was able to create at the Disney theme park was made possible not just by the resources the company brought to bear, and not just by their amazing creativity, but also, importantly, by the centralized control that they were able to exercise in building the town.
Rick, take us up to 1971 when the park opens. What was the reception, both locally, nationally, and further abroad?
Well, a lot of excitement. When the park opened, as you said in your opening, the attendance was modest, perhaps because people had been told that the place would be mobbed and they were fearful of coming that first day. But by Thanksgiving time, cars were backed up on Interstate 4 all the way to Orlando. And so there was a sense at that time, my gosh, this thing is really going to be what we thought it was going to be. But I think a key event was when the NBC Nightly News would broadcast in February 1972 from the Disney theme park. And David Brinkley, in the little editorial he used to give at the end of the news show, talked about Walt Disney World, but he talked about the Magic Kingdom not as an amusement palace, but rather as an exercise in urban planning, and talked about how other cities, he mentioned New York in particular, could learn from the way in which the Disney property had been planned, the way in which the air, the land, and the water were all coordinated one with the other.
A fascinating thing to think about today. We're talking about 40 years of Walt Disney World, and you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. My guest, Rick Fogelsong, has written the book Married to the Mouse, Walt Disney World and Orlando. We're also joined in studio by Lee Cockerell, who served as Executive Vice President of Operations at the Walt Disney World Resort until 2006. Lee, having heard that exposition on Disney and with your perspective on the inside, does all of that jive?
Well, I just learned a lot of things, too, so I'm glad I came today. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think the efficiency with which decisions are made and the speed with which buildings can be built, and frankly, it turns out that they're well done. We had all those hurricanes in 2004, and there was not really any issues. Didn't even make the insurance minimums to deductions, and so it's turned out well. I think it has worked well. I see when we build a road out there, we do it very quickly, unlike some governments that take a lot of time. So I don't think, as being on the inside, I worked for Disney, started in 1990, so I wasn't there in the early days, but it seems quite efficient and effective.
You know, from your position, looking at the Walt Disney World Park, do you see it as having to run, in some senses, a city government?
Oh, absolutely. I think, it is a city. I guess that's just to back up. It is a city. There's, I think when I was there, 1,000 bus drivers, there are monorail, boat drivers, 1,200 security people. I think every job that you could probably imagine, doctors, nurses, surveyors, engineers, it covers all aspects of a city.
And, of course, you've got all those people coming through wanting to have that magical Disney experience. What was your biggest challenge dealing with all those different logistics and making sure that that happened?
Well, I think expectations are incredible for people coming down to Disney. And the key, I've really learned through the year, the key, you got to hire the right people. And if you hire great people and train them and hold them accountable, somebody told me once, the only way you get excellence in an organization is training and enforcement. Train people and then hold them accountable to perform. And that's what Disney does well.
What did you see as your biggest challenge, though, on maybe a daily or even an annual basis with that park?
Well, I think on balance, I had a great life. Recessions were not fun. When you're trying to get the cost down, 9/11 was unbelievable. We had to take out about $350 million out of our cost base in a few weeks because business plummeted overnight. The hurricanes that came through in 2004, dealing with all of that and getting back to normal. But, those dips in business are the biggest problem.
In operations, though, is there something more pragmatic that you have to deal with?
No, I said every morning we get up every morning and try to get 60,000 people to behave themselves and take care of the guests.
That can't be easy. You make it sound
easy. It's not easy. Actually, it's not easy. And that's why I think even today I talk a lot about it. You got to really be careful who you bring into your organization because at the end of the day, that is the face of the company. Disney cast members are the brand at the end of the day. I mean, the rides are great and entertainment's great and all that, but most people write to us and tell us how great the cast members are about looking after them.
Tell me about, you know, being in that organization for more than 15 years. How much was the imprint of Walt Disney himself from that initial inception still carried through to that day? Was it, in your sense, did you get a feeling that it was a different organization than when it started? Had it changed that much?
Well, I came in 1990, so it's hard for me to say what was happening in the early years, but I tell you, Walt's mentioned a lot, and I think really he set the baseline for attention to detail. I mean, he was famous for that. Bringing technology. Somebody said, how'd Disney change over the time I was there? I'd say huge adaption of technology, and Walt was famous for that from all the early days when he was making the early movies and early cartoons. He was the man that was out there making that happen, and I think that became part of the culture and is part of the tradition of the company that pays a lot of attention to detail.
Now, I know both of you are not engineers, but we know that there is a vast superstructure to keeping the Magic Kingdom running. There's an underground network of tunnels that allow folks to go behind the scenes and keep that magical illusion real. Rick, were you able to uncover, you know, during your research, were there problems in constructing Walt Disney World out in its location, which is kind of a swampy area?
You know, one of the fascinating anecdotes, I think, about the construction of the theme park was when Walt Disney saw the property for the first time, and he's there with a man, Colonel G-E-E from Jim Jensen Engineering, and he looks at the water at what was Bay Lake, and it was brown, tannish, and not his image of what Florida was supposed to look like. And so he said to Colonel G, no, this won't do. Can you change it? And Colonel G said, well, I can if you've got the money. And so they did with Dredge and Fill. They dredged out the root mat that was at the base of the lake that was the source of the brownish color. And in its place, they pumped in white sand to try to keep the water blue or to make it look blue as the water does in some parts of the Caribbean. And in digging out all the root mat, they had a problem of what to do with that root mat, and so they piled it up, and then that became the basis for the tunnel network. The theme park itself was above grade on top of the root mat, and they tunneled through that to create the corridors that are used by the cast members and service personnel in order to access the various stages and whatnot within the park.
Lee, have you seen changes to that infrastructure at the park? Is it pretty much essentially the bones of what were laid down still?
I don't think you could change it much. It's a tunnel system, and I even remember when I first got here, they told me that the Brinks car had to be specially designed to fit in there to come and pick up
the banking car, right?
Yeah. So no, I think it's pretty much the same. I've seen photos of it early days, and it looks the same.
What do you think is the most interesting thing at the park that maybe most people who are your average visitors wouldn't know about it?
Well, I think it's different for everybody. I ran into some fellows this morning. I was being interviewed at the Magic Kingdom for a speech I'm giving in Oklahoma in March. And the attention to detail still, he was surprised at some of the little things he saw when he brought his daughter here. Mickey was about to walk off the stage, apparently, and it was the end of the night, and she ran after him, he told me. And he said, Mickey, actually turned around and came back, and he was blown away by somebody caring enough to do that sort of thing. So I would say that every person you deal with at Disney has been there, they have a different impression of what happened, or if they've just been married, or if they just had children, or if it's the first time bringing their child, or it's a different experience, I think, for every person over the years.
A theme that carries in your view of it is clearly the people that work there at Disney that make that experience happen for all the visitors who come to the park. What is special about that hiring process that keeps it and maintains that high standard? Is there something different Disney's doing that organizations elsewhere aren't?
I think so. I think they have a pretty strict profiling system, checking people out. There's a film you watch before you go to work for Disney that's very clear about expectations for working here, being on time, personal appearance, how you interact with the guests. And
that sounds like a fundamental thing, though. You're saying most organizations aren't at that level?
I don't think they are. I mean, just a full day of tradition training, I don't think most people are spending the money up front for the training, which is really going to pay for in the long haul. And I find out when I talk to companies, they're really not doing those things, how they onboard people, how they literally inject Disney into them in the first few days. And now, it's Disney, and people have all been there. Every kid wants, and they want to work there, so there is some advantage to people being excited about working there. But, it's select the right people. There's the can-do people in the world and the can't-do people.
Listen,
get more of the can-do people.
For all our entrepreneurs out there, you're getting the advice for free here.
Free.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando. We're talking about 40 years of Walt Disney World, which opened in Central Florida in 1971. I'm Mark Simpson. Where do you think Central Florida would be without Disney? Can you imagine the Mouse separate from Orlando and the Central Florida region? Or how has the park changed your life? You can tell us about it on the WMFE Facebook or Twitter pages. Send email over to intersection@wmfe.org. Lee, you mentioned technology and the role that has played, and Disney certainly known for forging ahead on different technologies. The animatronics in the park really stand out as one of the classic inventions that we've seen spread into other areas as well. So what do you know about the history of that, and how is it changing?
Well, I don't know a lot about the history of it, but certainly all the new technology, everything's getting smaller. It's more realistic. And I think sometimes we talk about the animatronics as the big technology thing, but I tell you, the way technology is coming today, how Disney's using technology to try to get those lines down and trying to get check-in done before you get here and get rid of those lines, which is the biggest complaint a lot of people have, and using technology for transportation and GPS and Where's Mickey through Verizon's app. And so technology is going to be gigantic in the next few years.
Would you agree that we've seen Disney in more recent years focusing less on expanding the park itself and more on enhancing the visitor experience in what currently exists? And tell me a little bit maybe why that trend do you see going forward?
Well, I think, I'm not sure you need more than four parks. I think they will expand those parks like they're doing now with Fantasyland. It's going to double the capacity of Fantasyland when it opens next spring. And it's probably take those four parks and just make them bigger as you can. And
they're looking to expand the princess theme.
Or the prince. You know, we love people that have princesses in their family. That's very profitable. Little girls with pink dresses. But, you can make the parks bigger. And, I mean, people can come for 2 weeks here and not be able to see everything. So at some point you get big enough, I think.
Also, in the works, we're hearing about an Avatar-themed park. And we've heard that is going to be rolling out in coming years. I wonder, in your experience, we've seen so many successes on fronts for Disney, carefully crafting its image. But there's also been some places where Disney's had to step back a little bit, recalibrate things. I remember that they've tweaked the Enchanted Tiki Hut that was under new management, and now it's kind of resorted back to its original state, more of the classic experience, if you could say that. So talk to me a little bit about that. You don't often see Disney having a retreat.
That happened out of new management, actually. The old management put it in, and then Bob Iger took it out. So,
why a theme like that? Is there a concern about losing some of the classic feel?
Well, I think it was a lot of people didn't get it when it was changed, and it was cute for some people who were on the inside and understood Hollywood and all that stuff. But Disney guests, tradition's important, and we were talking about tradition this morning. There's some good tradition, there's some bad, and of course, Disney guests want everything to be the same, and they want changes. And so sometimes we get into that with people. But I think going back to some of those things like Tiki, that was right to go back to how it used to be. There was no need for that kind of comedy that a lot of people didn't get, especially kids. They didn't get it at all.
Do you think with the plans for an Avatar-themed park, is Disney walking out on a limb there? There's supposed to be sequels to the James Cameron film in future years. We don't know how those are going to be received by the public.
I really don't know. Avatar, you know, all I know is what I read in the paper, and I'm not even sure when that's coming. You probably have better knowledge of that than I do. I've not even seen the movie Avatar, so I'm probably not a good one to comment on that one. I better talk to my grandkids tonight and ask them what the story is.
Mike Thomas of the Sentinel said that it had to do with blue monkeys, but I'm not going to take it further than that.
At Animal Kingdom.
Well, Rick Fogelsong, how do you see Disney as it's existed these 40 years in Central Florida? Has it changed much from the original vision when it was constructed?
Well, you know, to connect with something that Lee said, Walt Disney wanted to create something new with the theme park, a concept that he invented. And both in California and also here in Florida, he did not want his theme park to be located on the water, that is, on the ocean, on the beach, because he did not want it to be associated with a boardwalk, carnival-type atmosphere. He thought that was a turnoff for family entertainment. He wanted a different kind of experience, and as Lee was saying, a different kind of worker at the park. And I know the Disney Company has strived to maintain that. Now, I use the theme of love and marriage in my book, Married to the Mouse, and one adage that I use is that whom you marry affects what you may become. And that applies well to marriages, but I think also in the economic development marriage that occurred here. Orlando's economic takeoff was caused by Disney, and we became a tourist city. And the economic development challenge now for Florida is to try to move beyond that. Historians use a term, path dependence, to talk about issues such as this. And some historians would say, economic historians would say, that where you start from affects where you can get to. In some places, you can't get to from where you are. And so I think the challenge for Central Florida is to build upon what we've got, tourism, but also to transcend it and to move to an economy with higher wages, as you find in knowledge-based industries.
Just briefly, is that a threat for Disney then, to see a move away from less dependence on tourism?
I don't see it as a threat to Disney whatsoever. On the one hand, Disney is a high-tech company, as Lee was talking about. If you go behind the scenes, there's a great deal of technology. But nonetheless, not just at Disney, but in the other theme parks as well, we've got a service sector workforce here in Central Florida, and the service sector simply doesn't pay what manufacturing wages pay, and that's our challenge.
Lee, just last thoughts. What do you see briefly as the next horizon for Disney?
I think somebody asked me that yesterday, and I think they will keep doing what they do. I think staying relevant and continuing to change and applying technology and still make, you know, Walt said keep it clean and friendly and fun, and everything will work out just fine. And I really think that probably will happen no matter what they do in the future.
And Rick, what do you see?
I see Disney continuing to be in the forefront of the entertainment business. And again, our challenge is to move beyond that here in Central Florida.
We've been talking with Rick Fogelsong, who is professor of political science at Rollins College. He is also author of Married to the Mouse, Walt Disney World in Orlando. Also, we were talking with Lee Cockrell, former Walt Disney World executive and author of Creating Magic, Common Sense Leadership Strategies from a Life at Disney. Guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What's your favorite Disney memory or favorite Disney park? Tell us about it at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.